that one. Linda does seem to be recovering from the emergency surgery, so that was good. But we'll see when she gets back to physical therapy. That's going to be the big test because she was making some progress. So that was it. I appreciate all the prayers, the support, the things you all have done. She's grateful too. I know she would say the same thing. All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship and let's continue on here. We're dealing with this fact of Israel's physical first and then spiritual restoration, which we still are awaiting. They won't see the full story on this until we get to the millennium and on. We stopped here in finishing on verse 15 here. Verse 27, therefore here one need not make a sharp distinction between the spiritual life that will come to Israel, no doubt exemplified first by the 144,000, and the two witnesses. Those are the ones that are introduced there in the book of Revelation. The 12,000 from each particular tribe that's mentioned. And then the two witnesses, Moses and Elijah, will be resuscitated and brought back. It appears that the 144,000 are not confined to Israel, but it appears the two witnesses are. They appear to stay in the land. So that the greatest and the spiritual life will come to Israel, and the greatest expression of life and blessing that the world has or will ever see, that is the millennial kingdom of Christ. The Jews, he will be at his zenith, power and glory. The Jews will finally be restored to their position of greatness. And the church, of course, will be there in resurrected bodies as the administrative aspects of the kingdom. Well, 28, since the negative volition and rejection of the Jewish nation at large has inaugurated the phase of salvation history, beginning in Paul's day and extending until the current time, it should not be considered unusual for their restoration to usher in the final phase of salvation history. And 29, what should be evident is that Paul mentions nothing about the timing of all these events, which would seem strange if he was aware of some conclusive sign to which he could have pointed believers. He talks about this in very generalized terms. And in fact, when you really carefully consider Paul's prophecy, the prophecies that he provides, most of them are generalized. Paul's not very specific about a lot of things in terms of timing. Some have said, well, because of this, they believe that Paul thought the rapture would occur in his day. No, he did not. There's no question he did not, as we will see. So, 30, some interpreters have come to the conclusion that Paul did not mention anything regarding the timing, since he believed that this process would be concluded within his lifetime. That's wrong, by the way. They've concluded that, but it's wrong. However, there is nothing specifically to which one can point in Paul's writings that indicated that he believed God's plan for the world would be consummated within his lifetime. Or, as they've also alternatively said, that he was going to be the primary agent that would bring about the restoration of Israel. When one carefully considers his words, what he says about their fullness does not square with what he says about what he's doing. He wants to try to save some. He's not talking about the full restoration of the nation. He made that point back in chapter 11. Oops, 12, 11. He says in verse 14, if somehow I might move to jealousy my fellow countrymen and save some of them. He didn't think he was going to save them all. And to read that into his words, again, is eisegesis. It is foreign to what the text is actually saying. So in the book of Philippians, 32 here, to suggest that Paul believed the rapture was an event that would occur during his lifetime is to ignore what Paul says about his own experience. 33, in the book of Philippians, when he's addressing the matter of his Roman imprisonment. Now that we know, we can pretty well fix that from 60 to 62 A.D. and how it is to be resolved. He did not speak at all about the rapture, but spoke in terms of life and physical death. So to say that Paul thought he was going to be raptured is kind of to ignore what he actually says about himself. And he talks about the fact that they'd rather die and go be with Christ. He makes that plain in verse 21. For me to live is Christ, to die is gain. He doesn't talk in terms of being raptured, being taken out. He talks in terms of physical death. So to say that Paul expected the rapture in his lifetime, I think is totally foreign to his own language. But yet, people want to read into this. So he says, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that I will not be put to shame in anything. And that with all boldness, Christ will even now as always be exalted in my body, whether by life or whether by death. For me, to live is Christ, to die is gain. It's better. And that's how he looked at it. So in a similar fashion, in Paul's second letter to Timothy, written about 10 years after Romans, he makes it explicit that he knew he was going to die before seeing the events about which he is writing in Romans 11. 2 Timothy is that book. This is the final book of his canon that he wrote. And Romans was written in 57 AD, and this one was probably written in late 67 or very early 68 AD. So it's almost 10 years. 2 Timothy 1:12 does not suggest that Paul believed the day was near. In fact, his use of the phrase "in that day" is very consistent with the way in which the Old Testament prophets referred to the climactic period of human history. And he said, "For this reason, I also suffer these things. But I am not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed, and I am convinced that he is able to guard what I have entrusted to him, i.e. my soul, until that day." And that day is the concluding time of the human experience on this planet, as early life as we know it now. And then Isaiah chapter 2, you see that the Old Testament prophets use these terms in a very similar way. 2:11, the look of a proud man will be abased, and the loftiness of man will be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. And that's very, and of course, Paul is Jewish. He's very steeped in the Jewish scriptures. And his language is very parallel to this language of the end times. Also, Isaiah 11:1. Well, actually, that's not it. I don't know what I was looking for there. So let's scratch that one. 11:10. Is that it? Okay, let's try that. Thank you. Then in that day, the nations, that day, yes, there you go, the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. The root of Jesse is the Lord. Again, and his deity is emphasized there. And you can also see these other ones, Hosea 2, 16, 18, and 21. B, 2 Timothy 3, 1 and following indicates that Paul did not view the last days as being within the time he lived. Rather, he viewed the last days as sometime in the indefinite future. And he's talking about a time that sounds like, I mean, just as you listen, just normally the expression of it here, is that it's a day that's far off from when he's talking, in fact. As it turns out, it is. But realize this, that in the last days, difficult, dangerous, perilous times will come. And that was, I mean, while it was dangerous enough being a Christian in Paul's day, this goes well beyond all that. See in chapter 4, Paul makes it plain that his death is imminent and makes provision for the church in light of his impending departure. This would not have been necessary if Paul believed that the end was near. In fact, the very principle that we talk about, the Timothy principle, of training the next generation would suggest that Paul thought they needed to train the next generation. And again, this is something I think that's incumbent upon every group to the extent that it's necessary, that God opens the door for that, to training people to effectively do what we do. So 2 Timothy 4, 1 and following, I charge you solemnly in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead by his appearing and by his kingdom. Proclaim the word. Be ready in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction. For the time will come. And again, he's not saying they're in that time yet, although Paul knows that the defection from doctrine started early and was widespread. There were more people, again, fighting against the truth than for it. But that's the way it normally is. But wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance with his own desires. And then when he talks about dying, he doesn't talk about the rapture in verse 6, "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come." And he knows this. So he, again, to read this into Paul is to read it into it. Paul doesn't ever say anything like that. So 35, what this passage does confirm is that Paul recognized that national Israel had an administrative future within God's plan. Based on this, he will write to the Gentiles to guard against any tendencies to remove Israel, or substitute the church from Israel, for Israel rather, from their ultimate understanding of God's administrative purposes. And then, now, as we move on, in verse 16, he's going to offer, he uses a couple of analogies here that he's going to press the second one. He uses the first one, but he will press it stronger and use the second one and expand on it. If the first piece of dough is holy, the lump is also. But, or now, it's not actually translated. You have the weak adversative duh. If is the hypothetical particle here. Conjunction, rather. Introduces, again, a first-class condition. Again, when, since there is no to-be verb, we presume that this is true, actually. And it is, again. It is true in this case. If the first piece of dough is holy, the first piece is the definite article in the feminine, which just looks like H-E, hey. And then aparche, A-P-A-R-C-H-E. Aparche is used 9 times. The verb means to make a beginning, aparcheo. This term denotes the first part or portion of something, the beginning of something, the first fruit. Again, supply the to-be verb here. If the first fruit is holy, hagios. This means, again, this word emphasizes separation. Set apart to a particular purpose. Consecrated to God. We just use the single term holy. If the first piece of dough, they supplied of dough here because, again, they understand that this has the idea of first fruit, is holy, and we conclude that it is, then the lump is also. Actually, you have a different word order. You got chi here used in an adjunctive sense. Also of the lump. Is. Here you have a nominative neuter singular of the definite article with the word furama. P-H-U-R-A-M-A. Furama is used 5 times. It means a lump of something. It can mean dough or clay, something which you can work or mix or knead. So dough is fine here. Then the lump of dough, if the first piece of dough is holy, then the lump is also. If and chi connective now here, and if, another conjunction here, ei, another use for another first-class condition, and if the root, definite article in the feminine, he hriza, H-R-I-Z-A. You know what the root is, hopefully. It's the underground portion of a plant. It's what you don't see, but it's there. In fact, it supports the plant. The plant can't exist without the root. The root must be there before the plant can be there, in fact. So if the root is holy, supply again the to-be verb, hagios again. Also, the branches are too, or also. Another chi adjunctive here with this term in the definite article, klados. K-L-A-D-O-S, 11 times. 5 times, 5 of the 11 usages are in this chapter. So they kind of dominate the use of this. All right, let's move on here now, verse 16. This verse serves as a transition from the thought of Israel's future, which is implicitly described in verses 11 through 15, to the metaphor of the root and branches that will extend through verse 24. Paul introduces 2 metaphors from the Old Testament, each one focusing on the initial or foundational part, and then moving to the whole. They are designed to document his implicit assertion that Israel has an administrative future before God, that the nation is going to be restored at some point. And this will coincide, of course, with their positive volition, their desire to finally get with God's plan. 3, the first figure is taken from the Mosaic Law and deals with the Lord's command to the nation about the food they were to eat after they entered the land of promise. Our verses come from Numbers, part of the Pentateuch here, Numbers 15. 17 through 21. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, and say to them, when you enter the land where I bring you, then it shall be that when you eat of the food of the land, you shall lift up an offering to the Lord. Of the first of your dough you shall make up a cake as an offering, as the offering of the threshing floor, so you will lift it up. From the first of your dough you shall give to the Lord an offering throughout your generations." Now you think, well, how did he get that from that? Well, he does embellish a little bit on the metaphor. He takes this to say that if the first piece that you offer up is holy to the Lord, that consecrates or sanctifies the rest of it. Paul actually says in Romans, if the first piece is holy, the lump also becomes holy. And that's just what he's kind of saying here, that as you consecrate part of your, and again, this was an offering, a first fruit offering, to the Lord, then it sanctified the rest of it. Well, the Hebrew of verse 20 uses the term arisa. It is used only four times and means coarse grain or meal. Of the first of your dough, there in verse 20, of the first part of the head of your dough, literally, it's a word for the top or the head. So the New American Standard translators, as well as others, have recognized that the reference is not so much to the grain or meal as to what one makes from it. Dough. Okay, that's fine. See, the Old Testament teaching does not indicate that the offering of the first portion of the dough makes the rest holy. It doesn't come out and say that explicitly. Rather, the purpose of the offering seems to have been to sanctify the rest of the harvest for general consumption. And this is also taught in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus 19. Paul makes sometimes, I would say, somewhat liberal use of the Old Testament. He doesn't always stick necessarily. He's not a wooden-headed literalist. He may take the verse and read more into it than what people think he should. They've argued about this already in Romans. Many interpreters have. That he's too free and easy with his citations and quotations. And sometimes they don't reflect either the Hebrew or even the Septuagint. They reflect Paul's own kind of version of it. And some people don't like that. They think, well, he's too liberal. Well, Leviticus 19:23. When you enter the land and plant all kinds of trees for food, then you shall count their fruit as forbidden. 3 years it will be forbidden to you. It shall not be eaten. But in the fourth year, all its fruit will be holy, an offering of praise to the Lord. And in the fifth year, then you are to eat of its fruit, that its yield may increase for you. I am the Lord. But the point is, it was off limits for 3 years. Then the fourth year was the Lord's, and then the fifth year they could have it. But as they sanctified it by that offering to the Lord, then the rest became, we might say, holy. Well, as some have noted, it may well be that Paul was influenced by the principle that a little leaven will contaminate the entire lump. Now, this was a principle that he cited in his own writings, he was familiar with, but he was also talking in terms of evil. That when he uses leaven in his writings, that the idea is that of evil. Your boasting is not good. This was in the context of the incestuous Corinthian and their failure to deal with that, the leadership's failure to deal with that in the church. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough? In other words, a little evil tolerated within the church will spread. And this is why, unfortunately, as the overseer, you've got to keep an eye on people. You don't necessarily want to. It doesn't. It's part of the job, though. If people start becoming malcontents and this and that, promoting false doctrine and all that, well, you have to deal with it, unfortunately. Or if people are living in flagrant, unrepentant sinning in certain areas. Certainly sexual sinning within the congregation is not to be tolerated. In fact, there's so many exhortations about that, I don't know how you could miss that one. And so he uses the same thing also in Galatians 5:9. A little leaven, leaven is the whole lump. So F, therefore, it would not necessarily be unusual for one to think that the act of offering the first portion of the dough which was then, since it's offered to God, it's sanctified, it's holy. To extend the concept of holiness to the rest of the dough. Although, again, he uses these passages rather freely from, you know, their actual interpretation in terms of context. Well, the sentence is recorded, point four, in form of a first-class condition, which presumes the statement is true for the sake of the argument. And five, the noun aparche, first portion or first fruit, is generally used to indicate the initial that the initial work of God in a matter signifies that there is more to follow. 1 Corinthians 15, he uses this in the context of resurrection to indicate that when one has this concept of first fruits, that you expect a bigger harvest later on down the road. The first fruits are the smaller portion of it. But now Christ has been raised from the dead. The first fruits of those who are asleep. He was the first person ever to receive full resurrection body. We're not talking about resuscitation here. Other people came back from the dead. Elijah raised the widow's son there from the dead. Jesus raised people from the dead. Paul raised a guy from the dead. He fell asleep in Bible class. What's the hint there? That's subtle, huh? So, and then also here, verse 23, for as in Adam, all die. But each in his order in terms of the resurrection. Christ, the first fruits, after that, those who are Christ at his coming. That's the next wave. The rapture will signify the resurrection of the church. That's the second wave of resurrection. Then the first resurrection mentioned in Revelation is the resurrection following Daniel 70th week there, at the outset of the millennium. So six, the adjective hagios, holy, set apart, sanctified, is used in two distinct ways. The first deals with actual holiness, purity or moral righteousness, while the second denotes that which is consecrated or set apart for a divine purpose. And seven, it should be clear that the second meaning is the one in view. The Jewish nation as a whole was not sanctified in the sense of being experientially righteous before God, not at that time. But they'd certainly been set apart as the agent. Now that they had been sanctified, set apart for, to administrate God's plan to the world. And eight, what is not stated here is exactly how the reader is to understand the metaphor. It is clear enough in the literal sense. If the first part is holy, the whole is holy. Now, the argument, again, somewhat from the lesser to the greater. If this piece is good and it came from this big lump, then this lump must be good. Okay, we get that. That should be pretty plain. But the question one must answer is, how is it to be understood, and to whom or for what is it to be applied? Paul provides nothing in the immediate or following context that definitively explains how one is understand the first metaphor, or again, to whom we're going to apply it. So, 10, given that reality, I would argue here that the first portion of this is, to the reader, I would think, somewhat vague. Because it's talking about the restoration of Israel. We know the overall context has to do with the administrative future of the nation. That much we know. But what does this dough have to do with any of that? What is the first piece, and then all that follows? Well, given that reality, it makes sense to look to the second metaphor, the immediate following context, since it certainly appears to be parallel to the first teaching about the first fruit and the rest of the lump. And in this case, the first piece would correspond to the root, and the lump would correspond to the branches, if these are strictly synonymous parallels. And it appears that they would have to be, because Paul never explains it any other way. If he means something wildly different by this first metaphor, he doesn't say so. And so this would just leave the reader, to me, to guess. But if it's parallel with this second metaphor, and we can figure out what the second one means, then we can understand what the first one means. And so in this case, you have to actually work logically a little from back to front, as it were. So 11, this is deduced by the fact that the term first fruit literally means to make a beginning. And one can certainly understand the term root to refer to the beginning or foundation of the tree. And 12, what becomes clear is that the branches refer to the entirety of Israel, the believing remnant and the rest who have been hardened. But the root is not explicitly identified in the immediate context. He goes on in verse 17 to say, but if some of the branches. Well, this means that the branches, as we're going to see here, this refers to individual Jews, were broken off. And you being a wild olive. Now here he goes, interestingly enough, to a singular. You, and it just is like he's talking to an individual person. Well, he's addressing the Gentile church at large to let them know that you're a part of this now, part of God's eternal plan, but you're not separate from Israel in that sense. And now, we don't have to become Jews. Obviously, we don't have to go under the Mosaic Law and all of that. But the church finds its historical foundation in Israel, in God's plan for Israel. And this is why Paul doesn't want the church to be arrogant. If some of the branches were broken off, and you being a wild olive were grafted in among them, and became a partaker with them of the rich root of the olive tree, do not be arrogant toward the branches, i.e. the ones that were broken off, the ones in immediate context he's talking about. But if you are arrogant, you're not supposed to be, but if you choose this, remember that it is not you who supports the root, but the roots support. But the root supports you. So we'll have, and this is, this is very dangerous, because if you misinterpret this, you're either going to have to teach universal salvation, or you're going to have to teach the believer to lose his salvation. Those are the two bad misinterpretations I've seen come out of here. And both are wrong. Both have missed the point of what Paul's doing here. So, 13, there have been two distinct approaches to these two metaphors. The first is to take the terms first fruit and the term root to refer to the same thing. While the second is to make a distinction between the two metaphors and apply them to different things. Okay, but then you've got to get now to authorial intent. What is Paul trying to say here? What does he want? And how does he expect the reader to understand it? Well, 14, while it is somewhat convenient to split the two metaphors by applying the first fruit to the Jewish remnant and the term root to the patriarchs, that would seem to unnecessarily complicate what Paul is saying. A. Schreiner astutely notes that there is a conceptual parallel to the two analogies found in the book of 1 Corinthians. Now let's look at that one. One that has been typically misinterpreted, even among doctrinal pastors. They've missed the point of what's going on here. And Paul switches. He starts with an agricultural metaphor to alleviate, or to address at any rate, the sectarianism that was going on in Corinth. That people were getting off into their little cliques. They weren't a group. They weren't unified. They were claiming, as one says, verse 4, I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I am of Cephas. No, you're not. And he says, we're just laborers, and God's doing the work through us, and none of us mean anything in that at that level. And then he switches to a building metaphor. We are God's fellow workers, but you are God's field, God's building. Now, do the field and the building refer to the same thing? Yes. Yes, it refers to the believers in Corinth, specifically, there. He uses two analogies. One follows right on the heels of the other. But he develops the second one. He doesn't develop the first one. So according to the grace of God, which was given to me, like a wise master builder, I laid a foundation. And another is building on it. And this gets into the fact, it's pretty clear, verse 11, the foundation is the gospel. And that's the foundation of every church. For no man can lay a foundation other than the one which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. But he says, now I've laid the foundation, and other communicators are building on it. What are they building with? Well, some of them are building with gold, silver, and precious stones, which are analogous to sound doctrines, the doctrines of Scripture, God's Word. Others are building with wood, hay, straw, human viewpoint, traditions of men, even worse, doctrines of demons. But they're not building with sound teaching. And the gold, silver, and precious stones don't refer to SG3 at all in this context. It's foreign to what the passage is saying. The passage is an analogy, a building metaphor. So why? So each man's work will become evident. And he said, the exhortation, the warning first in verse 10, but each man must be careful how he builds on it. Every communicator has to recognize that they're building on God's foundation. And they better be careful of what doctrines they teach. They better be clear on this. Because there's a judgment coming on this. And in the context, the judgment is the judgment of communicators. Now, obviously, we recognize all believers are going to appear before the judgment seat of Christ. But this judgment looks to be a little more strict than the general judgment believers get. As it should be. As we should. We should hold our spiritual leaders to higher standards. We recognize we all have sin natures. We all are going to fail. But the reality is we want to build with the right material, the truth. And if you're not building with the truth, you're wasting your time, whatever you're doing. So if any man builds on the foundation, two categories of building materials, good stuff and really horrible stuff, each man's work will become evident. See, again, the emphasis is on each man. It's on the builder. It's on the one building at this point. For the day will show it, because it is to be revealed with fire. And the fire itself will test the quality of each man's work. If any man's work which he has built upon it remains, he will receive a reward. But if any man's work is burned up, he will suffer loss. And this is the communicator suffering loss at the Bema for failure to adhere to the strict, straight, and narrow of the truth. He himself will be saved. It's not like if I went nuts tomorrow and started teaching all sorts of weirdness, well, you'd get a new pastor shortly, I'm old. It wouldn't take long. I won't lose my salvation and all, but I'm going to lose a lot of reward. I'm going to lose what I could have had. And again, how many communicators are going to have the nickname Smokey up there? We'll see. Probably more than a few. Go over and stand by Smokey. So, in this passage here, again, Paul moves from an agricultural metaphor to describe the church to a building metaphor. And see, it would seem that Paul introduced the first metaphor to serve his immediate purpose about the Corinthian tendency towards cliques in the church. And then moved on to the second because he intended to more fully expand on the building metaphor, which he does. And I think a similar thing is going on here in Romans. This seems to be, to some extent, Paul's style. So a similar situation would seem to be in view in Romans 11. Paul uses the dough metaphor as a transition to the root and branches metaphor, one upon which he will expound in the verses that follow. So 15, there are advocates for both interpretations here, that one should separate these and that one shouldn't. So there's interpreters out there you can find on either side of this. Much as any issue of doctrine, you can find people that will take the wrong side and people that will have the right side. But those that see a distinction between the two figures have offered at least three ways of understanding the term first fruit. A, the first is to take the firm first fruit and the parallel term root to refer to Jesus Christ. This view is found in some of the early church fathers, say up to about 300 AD or so, and a few modern interpreters, and find support in the fact that both words are used of Christ. Okay, so both terms are used of him. Is that what he's got in view here? Well, we've seen the 1 Corinthians there, 15, 20 and 23. Christ is called the first fruits of those who are asleep. And in verse 23, he's called the first fruits. Revelation 5. But again, now, here's where the exegete better be very careful. Because you're taking a document Paul wrote in 57 AD, and you're looking to Revelation, which was written 40 years later by a different author, and saying, well, these have to be parallels. Well, they might or might not, but you've got to be careful with that. But we certainly do know that both of these terms are used of Christ. 5:5, and one of the elders said to me, stop weeping, because the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, there we clearly have the term root used, and applied to Christ, has overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals. Again, this mysterious book appears to be, in some way, the title deed to planet Earth. Then what has to happen for God to assume the kingdom that he's always planned? That Satan has been... Satan is a squatter. He moved in. There's an absentee landlord. Satan moved in and took over at the fall of Adam. Adam failed his authority test, and guess what? Satan swooped in and took his authority. Now, Adam still can do things, but Satan has become the prince of this world. He runs it. It's his world. And that's never going to change. Not in our lifetime. Oh, I mean, not during the course of life as we're knowing now. It will change. So he talks about the root there. And also 22:16, he calls himself that. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify these things. For the churches, I am the root and the descendant of David, the bright morning star. So someone apply this now in Romans, okay, are we to understand this as referring to Christ himself, the root? Is he? However, that seems out of place in the immediate context, which lacks any real Christological references. Additionally, one must recognize that symbols are fluid, and that each time a symbol is used, it must be considered in light of the context. Symbols are not like types. They are in some ways, but they are not in other ways. Types refer to real historical persons, events, institutions, etc., that prefigure something in the future. A type is inherently has a future aspect to it. Symbols don't, for one thing. They don't. And symbols can be used differently. So one has to be very careful when he applies a symbol and says, this symbol always means this. I can show you things. The term lion is applied to several things. It's applied to Jesus. Hey, wait a second. What did I just say there? I am the lion from the tribe of Judah? No, he didn't say it here. He talked about David. But he's identified as the lion from the tribe of Judah. Christ is identified as a lion. So the lion is a symbol for Christ. However, in 1 Peter 5, Peter says Satan prowls about like a roaring lion. So lion's a symbol for Satan. Now, which is it? Context, context, context. And when you go running off one book, five book, 20 books away to look for context, you've got to look at the immediate context, in context. This is what will destroy interpreters of the Bible. And they get locked onto a sign or a symbol. They say it always represents this. No, it doesn't. No, symbols are fluid. They don't always necessarily represent the same thing. So again, this doesn't seem here. I don't see in Romans here that you can read Christ into this. I mean, he hasn't referenced Christ in quite a while, really, in fact, other than the gospel. And that was just that they had to hear it. Well, see, although that view might tend to be confirmed by the vine branch analogy that Jesus used in John 15, one must recognize that the vine is not the root. And obviously there's a different, you know, even on a vine, you have a root and then you have the vine itself. So the second here is to take the first fruit to refer to Jewish Christians, which would teach that the existence of Jewish believers, i.e. the remnant, had a sanctifying effect on the nation at large and assured the future of the nation. Again, that seems out of point. Doesn't seem to be referencing the remnant here. He's talked about the remnant, that God left us a seed, a remnant, or we'd have been like Sodom and Gomorrah. But not in this context. He hasn't been talking about it. So the third is to understand the firm first fruit to refer to the Jewish patriarchs, beginning specifically with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who served as the initial foundation for God's plan to the world. Who was, we might ask, the first person through whom God really began to reveal and manifest his eternal plan of the ages for salvation, even salvation to the ends of the earth? Well, it was clearly Abraham. I mean, he was the one that got that promise. In you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Nothing like this was ever said to Adam. Now, Adam was, of course, the first administrator of God's plan, but he failed his test. And that administration, well, Satan took over the administration of the world from there. Again, he's a squatter. He's going to have to be thrown out because he won't go willingly. And we see that, too, sort of paralleled in Revelation 12 there, when finally Michael gets the go-ahead from the Lord to go get him. And he turns him loose on him. And so Michael and his angels waged war against Satan and his angels. And ejects them from heaven. Again, this is all, the timing of this is consistent with about the middle, maybe a little before, of Daniel's 70th week. The angels are being ejected from heaven, cast down to the earth. One of them, probably Satan himself, gets the key to the abyss, goes, opens it, lets those demons from Tartarus out. They've been down there for about 6,000 years now. Well, no, the flood was about 2,000, so they were been down there about 4,000 years stewing in their juices. The demons that were incarcerated for the Genesis 6 deal. And he lets them out. About that time, the U.S. gets nuked. And so literally all hell is breaking loose in the world by the middle of Daniel's 70th week. People aren't going to know, as it says, men's hearts failing them for fear, for the things that are coming upon them. Well, the third again is to understand it as this. Hosea chapter 9. Verse 10. I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your forefathers as the earliest fruit on the fig tree in its season. But they came to Baal Peor and devoted themselves to shame. Again, the forefathers here, not in this context, not specifically Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but again, more referencing the Jews of the Exodus at that time. But again, this is the nation. God funnels His plan through Abraham down to the entire world. And it all went through Abraham. So I would see Abraham as being the initial root in all of this of God's administrative purposes. However, it should be noted that even those that see a distinction between the term first fruit, again, many apply it to the remnant, and the term root almost universally acknowledge that the term root in some way refers to the Jewish patriarchs, the covenants God made with them, and the blessings and responsibilities that flow from those covenants. And that's what an administrator is. He's got privileges and blessings, but he's also got responsibilities. And Israel had all their blessings and privileges, but they failed their responsibility to be a light to the Gentiles. So given all these facts, point 17, coupled with what Paul will explicitly affirm later in this chapter about the nation's status as it relates to the patriarchs, it would seem that Paul is using the two metaphors to make a single point. If you look ahead to Romans 11:28, he actually here finally references them. And I think this is the key to it. From the standpoint of the gospel, the unbelieving Jews are enemies for your sake. They're enemies. They've made themselves enemies of God. But from the standpoint of God's choice, they are beloved for the sake of the patriarchs, the fathers. The promises made to them means that God still loves Israel in spite of their failure. So 18, the first fruit and the root then both refer to the foundation of the Jewish nation as established on and by the relationship God had to the patriarchs, through whom God chose to administrate His plan for Israel and for the world. Again, even in the promises to Abraham, it's evident that it was never meant to be Israel only. In you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Not just Israel. Your descendants will be as the sand of the seashore, as the stars of the heaven. But ultimately, this is for the world at large, this covenant. It was not designed to be limited just to Abraham. It takes in everybody. 19, in fact, the key to understanding this section of Romans, which is filled with a number of theological difficulties, if not approached properly, is to understand the reality of dispensations and the fact that God uses different agents at different times in history to reveal and advance His plan. The initial part of it ran through the patriarchs up until the time then of the foundation of the nation. That's the during the time of the conquest and beyond. Circa 1405 to 1399 were the years for the conquest. So again, if not approached properly, it creates some real problems. As a matter of fact, you're going to come to some... I've watched any number of decent interpreters. I mean, they can do good. They've done good work elsewhere. And then they get to this and they fall all over themselves. I mean, it's because they're not approaching it dispensationally. They're not understanding what he's... They want to make this individual because the branches are individual. But in a sense, unbelieving Israel as a whole is broken off. The Gentiles as a whole are plugged in. The church, obviously. The church is largely Gentile. Very, very few churches even have a Jewish believer in them. Typically speaking, you'll find some. There's a few. I think Seamus has one up there. Maybe a couple. I don't know. But we don't. Anybody here Jewish? No. Church is largely Gentile, always has been. And that's why Paul addresses the Gentiles specifically here. Because he knows they're largely the church. Well, 20, the Greek term oikonomia, administration or dispensation, which is derived from the noun oikos, house or household, is defined as the work of an oikonomos, the steward or manager of a household or an estate. And in that regard, point 21, God's plan is viewed as His household, which He entrusts to certain appointed administrators at different times in history. This began with Adam, continued through men like Seth. Obviously, these men certainly must have received revelation God worked through the believing line and maintained a continuity of believers throughout the antediluvian ages, up until the flood. Then he chose to work his plan through Noah, only one guy at that point. And the whole plan of God fell or rose at that level, we might say, with Noah. What if he fails on that boat? What if there's a leak? Well, bummer. Since the water covered all the high mountains of the earth by about 22 feet, how long can you tread water? Well, see, every guy, and his plan was down to 8 people at that time in history. You think, well, God, that was close. Oh, there's been times when the line of Messiah was down to 1 person. If that person, something would have happened to them, the whole thing would have blown up. So He's not concerned in that sense with the small numbers. He can work through anything. So again, this is a household, and we manage it. The church does now, as we'll see. 22, the initial management of the household through individuals was ultimately bestowed on the nation of Israel, who administrated his plan for over 1,500 years. And 23, as dispensationalists have recognized, the administration given to Israel was removed from them and bestowed upon the church, who is now to function as the pillar and support of God's plan. Now the church has temporarily has been almost 2,000 years now, but has temporarily replaced Israel. But that's not going to be permanent, as we're going to see. And that Mark passage, that's the one we looked at. We looked, I think, at the parallel in Matthew earlier. Yeah, it's the absentee landlord. And the one difference in Mark and in Matthew was, he says, he will give the vineyard to others. When they answered the question, the unbelievers, they said, well, he'll rent it out to other people. When Jesus addresses this parable himself, he answers the question and then he asks it in verse 9, or asks it and then answers it. He will come and destroy the vine growers and will give the vineyard to others. The administration of his plan is taken away from Israel, given to the church. It's that simple. In 24, the dispensational theologian, as opposed to covenant theologians, recognizes that God's plan is complex, but that the primary purpose of the plan is to reveal the glory of God. God's plan is to reveal his glory and share it with those who want it. It's that simple. And the plan of God isn't to save people. That's a part of it. But it was never God's. And again, the world acts like God should save everybody. No, he shouldn't. He doesn't need to and he doesn't want to. Now, he desires for people to be saved, but he's not going to interfere with their volition. And universal salvation was never God's plan. I think we should see that by now. That if you look at history, you see that, well, most people never did believe. Well, then God's failed. No, because that wasn't his plan. His plan was to reveal himself. And that he is succeeding at. So 25, while it is very easy to focus on God's plan only in terms of the salvation of the elect, God is obviously doing much more than bringing to salvation those whom he foreknew. Now, he is doing that. We're not arguing that. His eternal purposes also include his plan for his son. Now, what's the plan of God for Jesus Christ? Well, it's to exalt him above every creature that's ever lived. And that requires things he's got to do that. Not the least of which was, of course, his suffering. His plan for the angels. He's got a plan for them, fallen and elect. We know his plan for the fallen angels is the lake of fire. What is his plan exactly for the elect angels? Well, we're never really told that because the Bible's really not a book about angels. It addresses angels. We know they exist. But it's not a textbook on angels or what God's plan is for them. We see that they appear to administrate God's plan now from the heavenlies, sent out to minister to those who would inherit salvation. What's his plan for the angels in the future? Well, we don't totally know. I haven't been told. I don't see anything in the Bible about it specifically. And his plan for Israel and his plan for the nations of the world. So he's got a lot of irons in the fire, let's say. God's a busy fellow. And that's why he doesn't listen to you when you pray. No, I'm kidding. He's busy. He's got a lot to do. You think he's not listening sometimes, don't you? You wonder, are you hearing me? But he's busy. But there's a lot to his plan here that has to be taken into account. People only tend to focus on God should be saving everybody. No, he shouldn't. But based on what? There's no verse in the Bible that suggests that. He wants people to be saved, but he won't make them. Well, 26, although God's plan is unified, The dispensational theologian recognizes that his plan is brought to fruition by means of how and who he chooses to administrate his plan to the world. Who does God choose to work through? See, everybody else is bogus. They're spurious if God hasn't picked them. This is why, see, I've always said this. Any parachurch organization is no good just by its very definition. It's not a church. So I don't care what all these people are doing out there. The Salvation Army, Crusade for Christ, a Campus Crusade, Jews for Jesus, and all this. Now, are they doing some good work? Maybe. I don't know. I don't care. But I do know they're not the administrators of God's plan, the local churches. We are to administrate and handle the principles of doctrine and contend earnestly for the faith. And get the principles out there as much as it relies on us. And be the lights that we're called to be. Well, 27, there can be no question for the responsible exegete that the section beginning in chapter 9 and continuing through the end of this chapter must be understood in a dispensational sense and not strictly in a soteriological sense. That this section is not geared to the salvation of the individual. He dealt with all of that up through chapter 8, which included our future glorification. And he had dealt with all of that. The salvation of the individual has been covered in Romans. 9 through 11 isn't about the salvation of individuals. It's about corporate entities and understanding the dispensational realities of God's plan. So 28, in the first two chapters of Romans, Paul had indicted all mankind, dealing with the condemnation of the Gentile world in the first part there, 1:18 through 32, and detailing the condemnation of the Jew in chapter 2. And, I see our time is gone, so we'll have to pick up with this. We get a little bit of a review here of how Paul has set up Romans as he's gone, but that we'll have to wait till Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. May God, the Holy Spirit, enlighten us. In Christ's name, amen.